Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy. Speak and Destroy is the podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Butterside vocalist Patrick Allen Stone. When Patrick crossed paths with Lemmy, his entire life changed. The Motorhead frontman and his bandmates all made regular appearances at his home. When Velvet Revolver was searching for someone to replace Scott Weiland, Lemmy recommended Patrick to Slash, which led to a phone call from Matt Sorum and several demos. Lemmy personally signed Butterside to Motorhead Music, and his son, Paul, produced their debut album. Phil Campbell guests on the band's second album, Spiritual Violence, released in March 2021. Patrick and I talk about his relationship with Lemmy, his upbringing, jamming with Slash and Steven Adler, and of course, Metallica. You can support Speak and Destroy on Patreon and get access to exclusive bonus episodes culled from my interview archives over the years with guests like Glenn Danzig and Kirk Hammett. You can follow Speak and Destroy on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. And remember, Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network, so check out our other podcasts. So here it is, my conversation with Patrick Allen Stone of Butterside. This is Speak and Destroy. Tell me a bit about your earliest musical memories and at what point you knew, okay, this isn't just something that I love. This is something I need to participate in. I need to make this part of it.
Yeah. It was really early on for myself. I had my sister, rest in peace. She was just this huge influence. She was just full of energy and had this really rebellious attitude that I somehow thought was just the most amazing presence in my life. So I would follow her around and just try to copy her and do everything she did. You know, she was amazing, but she had this record collection. And I think before I was into toys or anything else, I was just going through her record collection and I really gravitated towards, rock and roll. I mean, the first album cover I ever remember really being drawn to was Highway to Hell. Just something about Angus holding his tail and having those horns, like the whole, I didn't understand yet that it was evil or if it was good or whatever it meant or what it was symbolizing. All I know is I thought it was just so damn cool. And, her listening to loud music and she would cut my hair to look like rock stars and everything like that. So I think I was only 5 years old when I was tugging at my father's pant leg. And, you know, he was asking me what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to be a rock star like those guys, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
That young. That's amazing. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And rest in peace to your sister. And yeah, thank God for those. I had an older brother who was also very pivotal in turning me on to different stuff when I was very young as far as music. So that's such a gift to be able to have that.
Yeah, you wake up to it. You know what I mean? The loud music's coming out of their bedroom. You go in there. The older kids are hanging out. They're smoking cigarettes. They're getting tattoos. They're doing all these things. And you just like, oh, okay. So that's what it's all about. And then you go out and you see other kids that aren't doing that. And you're like, oh, yeah, well, I'm gonna show you something. You know what I mean? I'm going to show you what's cool. You know?
Exactly.
Yeah, turning other people on to music that they haven't heard yet, I think, is like one of the coolest things in life, you know?
It really is, man. It really is. The fact that I have people in my life that we've been doing that with each other for decades, you know, it's always fun that keeps going.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool that there's a lot of new music coming out now too. That's leaning a lot more towards guitars and, you know, real musicians and stuff like that. So I love that there's you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. You know what I mean? We've had some dark years in rock and roll and metal and everything else. And it seemed like there were a lot of people, a lot of naysayers. And now it's just like the world is just completely saturated with new rock and roll and guys playing guitar and heroes to look up to and rebels, you know, it's great.
Yeah, amazing. So tell me about your evolution, how that, you know, turned into being a musician yourself. At one point you knew that you were going to be serious about it.
Going back to my sister, she gave me my first guitar, which was way too big for my hands to stretch, but that was probably, again, a blessing. You know, I just picked that thing up and, like, you know, it was kind of all the kids in the neighborhood wanted to play, you know what I mean? It was like, you know, it was cool to be like into the Who and into the rock and roll bands and stuff like that. So like a lot of kids just wanted to do it because it was cool. And then my sister gave me this guitar and, you know, I just found myself fascinated with it. And I saw all the other kids trying to pick up an instrument and failing miserably. And I just kept kind of, you know, plucking away. And before I knew it, I could play, I don't know what it was. It was like, like Wipeout or something, you know what I mean? Some stupid song that, like, not stupid song, God, but there's great songs, but like some easier riff that, like, I finally was starting to understand. And then just kind of going to it and then finding out that, like, I kind of felt like I had a connection where other kids didn't. And then, you know, trying to form bands and just early on, my brother played drums and later kind of moved away more towards sports, but I found myself just really loving music. And I loved the way that, like, I got the reaction out of people at school. Just the whole, you know, the whole thing about music was just this, it felt like you had to be like a chosen one, like you were special, you know what I mean? Like the same way that, like, maybe the quarterback in the football team felt when he could throw the football well. I just felt like I had this connection to music, and I was just so fascinated with it that it just kept growing and growing. And I think I ended up taking my brother's drum set because I ended up playing it a little better than he did. And he got mad and, you know, kind of gave it up. It's funny. I got into, like, all different types of music. I mean, I loved, like, Chicago, and I loved Billy Joel, and I loved, Journey, and anything. I would get in the car with my mother, and she would play whatever was on the radio. I would learn the lyrics and sing to, and she encouraged that. So that was cool. But around the time I got into high school, I was already growing my hair out. That was the last time I think I cut my hair. Honestly, I've had long hair ever since.
Amazing.
But I remember, I think it was like the first day of high school. You know, the guys, you know, they had the chains on their belts, and they had the Metallica patches and the Slayer patches on the back of their jeans jackets. And these fuckers lit me up. They put me up against they lifted me up against the lockers and, like, you know, started giving me a hard time. And I didn't know if it was because of the t-shirts I was wearing or the bands I was listening to, but I was listening to, like, Metallica, and I was, I remember I had the Ride the Lightning albums. I remember us, I think the first time I really got into Metallica, just to, you know, start going down that path, we would build these skateboard ramps, and huge ones up in the Los Gatos Hills. This is Northern California. And one of the guys in our group would put in, you know, Master of Puppets to get us psyched up going up to the skateboard ramps. And it was like, without that adrenaline from that music, like, we wouldn't have tried the tricks that we were attempting or built the ramps that were like 10 to 20 feet high, literally, like these huge ramps. You know, professional skateboarders from all over the area, we'd be coming up to the ramps, and these guys would be on the ramps already skating them. They'd broken into the property, and we would run up there ready to tell them to get off. And then you see it's like Tommy Guerrero or Tony Hawk or whatever. And we would crank Metallica all day. And that's just what kept us going. So I was already a fan, and I didn't understand why these kids.
Right. Like, what's the difference? Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, like, I literally remember one coming up to me in math class, and he literally took my Walkman away from me. And I was listening to Ride the Lightning. And then he kind of gave me this look like he was confused. You know what I mean? He wanted to think that, like, he was cooler than I was, but, like, you know, I wasn't listening to it to be cool. I just liked it. You know what I mean? I liked it. I know that Metallica was like coming to like San Francisco, the Bay Area, and my brother and my friends, we would go up there, and I was too young to get in, but we would still sit in line thinking we had some chance to get in to see them. And I remember we couldn't see them, but it wasn't, I mean, it must have been a few weeks into my freshman year that this kid Chris was standing out there waiting for me outside the school gates. And I guess I'd already had some reputation for being a singer. I guess I'd told a few people that I was a singer, but I wasn't quite sure that I was yet. You know what I mean? It wasn't like my thing, but this kid asked me if I wanted to sing for his group. They had the high school band, and he was like, yeah, we play like Metallica and we play Ozzy. And I was like, fuck yeah, I want to do that. So we like literally started rehearsing immediately, and we were playing these high school parties like within the month, and we were covering nothing but Ozzy and Metallica. And then I remember seeing those same kids at those parties and being like, yeah, bitch, I'm singing this shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then we'd play at lunch. Like, I don't think any of the teachers, the principal had any idea what we were going to do, but like, you know, they walk out of their offices and we're out there playing, you know, songs from Kill 'Em All and stuff like that, and recess and stuff like that. It became my entire existence. Everything was all about, you know, the whole lifestyle, you know, and had plenty of heroes to look up to and follow. So that's basically where it started.
That's amazing. And I love that story about the, sometimes how there's outsiders amongst the outsiders, you know, because I think of like the thrash metal dudes as like, you know, bullied by jocks. And then here they are then bullying people who are into like the wrong kind of metal or whatever it was, you know?
Right. There were so many different, it's like we had 10 or 15, 20 different genres of metal within metal, right?
Yeah.
Like you could be like the poser metal guys was what they were basically trying to put me into that box.
Right.
You know what I mean? But and it's funny because now we're all lumped together. You know what I mean? If you look at it now, it's like, you know, Poison and Metallica are on the same playlists all over the place. You know, while some of us will still fight to say that, you know, they're different, and they are. They definitely are in many ways. But it's funny, those kids, those bullies end up like this one kid, Brian Domingo. He and I, that same guy that lifted me up against the lockers and like they threatened to beat my ass because I wasn't metal enough. That kid ended up like moving in with me because he had problems at home. And, you know, my father ended up giving him lunch money, and he lived with me, I think, for God, the later part of our freshman year, all the way through the sophomore year. Wow. And he became like an actual part of my family. And then we grew to love, you know, all those bands together. You know, we just rocked out and banged our heads every time we went in and got into the car, we'd crank it up, you know.
Wayne's World style.
Totally Wayne's World style. We were those guys for sure.
So do you remember what it was at first that really grabbed you about Metallica, about that, you know, that stood out or made you want to keep, you know, skating to it or covering those songs? And
like, again, going back, I think Master of Puppets is where it really sunk in for me. But then, like, I mean, if I started listening to the Garage Days stuff and just everything. But the first thing was just that power, you know, that chorus, Master, that whole thing was just like, I mean, yeah, I mean, standing up on top again of a 20-foot skateboard ramp that we built and not having the balls to do it. And then that song comes on and you're like, fuck it. You know what I mean? It was that whole mentality, that whole strength, it was just tight too. Like even Slayer, I love Slayer. I loved how heavy they were, but it's like Metallica had something. I'm not going to say it's better because I love all of those groups equally. Maybe Metallica a little bit more. It was just tighter. You know what I mean? And the vocals were just his lyrics, just everything. And then, the lyrics and then the whole, I think that was really my, you know, the drug addiction element to Master of Puppets and its lyrics, the war element, you know, the Harvester of Sorrow and all of these songs, just, I really got in and really read the lyrics. And I just thought it was really cool that they weren't singing about the same old shit. you know, like, you know, girls and stuff like that. And I started to understand why these guys were standing up for something that meant more to them than these fluff pieces, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. to speak, you know, guys that had to, you know, they weren't trying too hard. They did have an image that was completely thought out without being thought out. It looked like they weren't trying, you know, to be somebody that they weren't. They were just fucking hard. They were sweaty. They got up there. They just kicked your ass. It lifted you up. You wanted to, it just felt so powerful. You know what I mean? You wanted to listen to it loud all day long. You wanted to show all your friends on 10, you wanted or 11, you wanted to listen to it all day long. So just the power behind it. You know what I mean? Just mm-hmm. The whole movement of it, you know what I mean? During that time, it was like, it was still kind of fresh, you know what I mean? But like, I don't know, just the power of it, you know, really.
I want to talk about, you know, of course I want to talk about Lemmy. And before we get to the great legendary, iconic Lemmy, you've, you know, had an opportunity to work alongside a handful of hard rock luminaries who are somewhere in that Metallica orbit, you know, that we would associate together. You know, I know Slash and Duff and Matt Sorum, and of course you were the front man for Adler's Appetite for a time, and mm-hmm. the late Frankie Benali and Simon Wright. And, you know, how did some of those, you know, if you want to pick some of those out and tell me a little bit about how you encountered those folks and what you ended up doing together and that sort of thing.
The Frankie Benali thing, God rest his soul, such a sweet guy. Yeah, they I think he had called it quits, you know, and it was just random. It was I was, you know, trying to make a name for myself here in Hollywood. I had a band called Aces and Eights, which actually led to a lot. I mean, I have that band to thank for so many things. My boy Taz Rudd, the founder of that group, he was just a phenomenal guitar player, but he ran with Axl and Izzy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I considered myself a musician and a songwriter for, you know, my entire life, ever since, like, I was in those bands back in high school, like I told you about. I mean, I was writing songs even, I mean, my sister gave me that guitar and I was off and running. I think I wrote my first song shortly after, and I was like 9, 10. I started writing songs, no matter how silly they were. I mean, I still have the lyrics sitting around somewhere, but getting a little off base here, but
no, this is what we
yeah,
did.
I was trying to make a name for myself, and I guess I'd made enough of one that, like, I got enough of a reputation, and I'd already gotten that was my point, was that I'd consider myself a songwriter and a musician, but like, I basically was, you know, I was addicted to drugs for a long, long time, and I completely you know, pulled myself away from the real world and just did that, and was writing songs and really gaining a vast spiritual education through drugs and alcohol and whatever else. And definitely music got me through all of that, but I made the turn to become sober, and that led to, like, really paying attention to some career moves. And this guy Taz walked into a strip club I was bartending at and he was with a friend of mine. He just asked me to come start jamming with him. So this band Aces and Eights led, one thing led to another, and we started playing out a lot in Hollywood and gaining some momentum and, you know, getting a lot of people at our shows and a following and all that. Around that time, there was just this girl that I knew, and she somehow knew Frankie, and the conversation came up about singers. And, you know, Frankie was finally thinking about, you know, redoing Quiet Riot, without Kevin. So, she reached out and she asked if it was okay that you know, he gets my number, and I was floored, you know. I was actually, I mean, that started this it's funny because the whole thing on my part was, to be completely honest, it was nothing short of a failure, but I'll say failure, and I'll quote Yoda on this one, that failure is our greatest teacher. Yeah, so Frankie came to an Aces and Eights show, and literally he was at the Key Club, and in the middle of our set, I knew he was going to be there, And in the middle of it, he came up, like, literally I'm on stage with my bandmates, and he was like, yeah, it's you, you're the guy. And, you know, he gave me like a, you know, we kind of grab hands, not really a handshake, but like a brother shake, you know? Mm-hmm. And I knew that, like, he was gonna, you know, I knew something was going to happen. So he ends up coming up to my apartment, and he lays all of these songs on me, and I'm just like trying to play it cool. You know, this was like really my first opportunity to be at like a really larger than life band, you know, work with some people that really had some fame and success. And I started trying to sing those songs. Lo and behold, man, those songs are fucking insane to sing. and like, yeah. I'm literally thinking, okay, I've got to try really hard. I had zero professional music, you know, like technique education. Like, I'd never taken a lesson. I just was like the, you know, shoot from the hip kind of a guy, sing and have feel. And that was more important than notes and everything up until that point. And that had gotten me by. So I literally got in the rehearsal room with these guys. And I think we went at it for about 2 months, and slowly but surely I was getting a little bit better at memorizing the songs and a little bit more confident, but at the same time I was losing my voice, because it was so hard to, like, I thought you just push, you know, you just push as hard as you can and you're going to hit those notes. And that's mm-hmm. not the case. You know, guys like that go through extensive training. You know what I mean? They really know exactly what they're doing with their vocals, you know, to keep them from frying out. So about 2 months into it, or actually about a month into it, I started taking professional lessons to try to salvage this, these auditions and these rehearsals that were, you know, I already knew they were starting to go south. But, so I took on a whole new musical technique, a whole new singing technique in the middle of it. And I started seeing this guy, Ron Anderson, who's like a professional to all of the stars.
I was going to say, I've heard his name. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, he's the guru. And I got, you know, again, like I said, it was like, just things started happening along with sobriety, just one thing after the other, just started happening, which kind of, you know, reassured me that I was still on the right path, you know, like that this was something that I really could do while I still was running into this wall with Quiet Riot, that it was something, this wasn't going to work out. You know what I mean? So they literally had to do, about 2 months into it, they finally had to shut it down, and they went with another guy. And then they went with another guy and another guy and another guy.
yep.
But this started a huge spark under my ass that, like, oh my God, I was so close to having, you know, a professional gig. Mm-hmm. And I was still with Aces and Eights, and it was kind of disrespectful to them. And, you know, the way I was going on about, like, still seeking, like, you know, I felt it was like, I don't know, I was kind of like an opportunist in a way, and I feel bad about that still, but they understood, you know what I mean? And those guys, Taz included, they supported me. They introduced me to Slash when they were looking for, you know, a new singer. And then, you know, I had been Lemmy's roadie back when I was high, you know, and Lemmy always pushed me to be a singer and a songwriter because he liked that about me. He loved the songs that I was writing even back then. But about the same time that whole thing with Velvet Revolver popped up and Scott had left, I had quite a few different ins through this group Aces and Eights I was with. And Lemmy made the call to Slash to give me a call. And I get a call one day from Matt, and Matt Sorum says, you know, Lemmy has spoken to us and he thinks that you're the next singer for our group. So let's record some stuff.
And that was, you know, to reverse engineer the timeline on that a little bit. I don't know if I mentioned this to you when we spoke before, but I actually was at the very first ever Velvet show, at the El Rey. It was when I worked at MTV and I was there covering the show, and I actually interviewed the band beforehand. They did like a press conference and then they did a separate interview with us. Yeah, it was killer. They played Set Me Free and Slither. Ang Lee, who directed The Hulk, was there. Set Me Free was on the Hulk soundtrack.
Yeah.
And they did Negative Creep, Bodies by the Sex Pistols, and you know, It's So Easy, wow, and Sex Type Thing. So it was a short set with only, you know, two Velvet songs, but you know, the Nirvana cover, the Pistols cover, everything was amazing. And then, of course, I know there was that whole period leading up to them getting Scott, where there were different names that you would hear around. And then after Scott was out, there were different names that you would hear around. And you getting that phone call was really then right towards, of course, there was no way to know this at the time, but that ended up being like really the end of the era of that band, right?
Where they
had been kind of, you know, rumors were going around about who they were going to get and this and that. And then, you know, they just never came back.
Going back to just how, like, all of this stuff with the, I mean, I was such a huge fan of all of these groups. I mean, still going back to those high school days and those bullies and all that stuff, like, I did start to veer definitely more toward a path of, like, I mean, when Guns N' Roses came out and all of that stuff, it was just like, that took over my life. And like, I looked enough like Axl Rose, and like, I couldn't put a hat on backwards without the entire high school, like, you know, calling me Axl and like doing everything short of throwing tomatoes at me. I mean, I literally couldn't do anything. Like, I wanted to wear the t-shirts because I loved the group and I was a fan. I couldn't help it. I was listening to the music. But like, Guns N' Roses made this just a huge impact. I mean, I was the kid that was just bouncing up and down on his bed, listening to Paradise City for the first time, just like completely like enlightened. You know what I mean? My whole world came to this focal. I mean, like I was on, it's like I was on the tip of a rocket ship. You know what I mean? That just took off. And like, I mean, I don't know if I knew it, but like, I just felt like I had a bigger connection to the whole thing. I had no idea how my life was going to unfold and how these supernatural occurrences were going to take place. Like, it's beyond my wildest dreams. It still seems like a lie and something I made up when I look back and then I see the pictures and I go, oh, yeah, that fucking really happened, you know? But, you know, the whole thing with the, like I said, I was doing a lot of drugs. I was in a drug den for for years and years and years. But I was so close to it still at that point. Like, I was hanging out with all the strippers that fucked all the guys in Guns N' Roses. And like, I was fucking those chicks. And that made me feel like, well, if I can fuck these chicks, then I can fucking be on stage like those guys. You know what I mean? And it's funny because those girls actually loved me enough that the first time that when Guns N' Roses had broken up, they literally gave, you know, they were looking for somebody and they were calling it The Project back then.
Right.
And I was so fucking high, dude. I was slamming dope every day. I had a whole house full of, you know, music equipment in Silver Lake. I was slinging drugs to, you know, to everybody in the industry. Like, I mean, I was kind of infamous, you know what I mean? Guys from rock bands like, you know, the Scorpions and Motorhead would come over to my house and they would hang out for days, and literally I wouldn't sleep for days, and we'd write music and whatever and hang out. But like, lo and behold, my friend Gabby like literally says, dude, you should sing for fucking Guns N' Roses. And I was like, yeah I should, you know. So she calls Slash and she actually gets him on the phone, and she puts me on the phone with Slash. And I remember that phone call lasted all of maybe 40 seconds because I literally I can't remember what I said, but I know I remember hearing his voice and him asking me a few questions. And like, I was just so strung out.
I was going to say, wherever he was in his recovery, he probably smelled you a mile away, you know. It's like, oh, this guy's loaded.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it was over so quick, and it was like, I knew I'd missed my opportunity. And yet in the other room, I had these bootleg copies of like, this one guy kind of like really had a shot at it. And he came over to my place because I kind of had this recording equipment, and he came over like asking me to do him a favor and record him for this audition for those guys. My friend, Paulie Rockwell, he was recording this shit, and the whole time I was like, fuck, I can rip this guy's asshole, you know, I can rip him a new asshole. So like, he left, and like, it was supposed to be so under wraps, and he thought he was taking all the stuff home with him, and then I was sitting there at night working on the shit, you know what I mean? So like, I get on the phone with Slash, and I thought I had this whole presentation ready to blow his mind, and then like, he just, you know, he hung up because I was an addict. And then lo and behold, years and years later, I get this call, you know what I mean, to record this stuff. And then I'm recording these songs, and it's going well enough that I start submitting the songs to them, and then they ask for some more. And my friend, Howard Tiemann, was great friends with those guys too. So I met with Duff at Duff's tattoo shop. And I think I kind of scared him off even at that point, because I was just so fucking excited. I couldn't get that childhood kid out of me. You know what I mean? It just kept pouring out. Like, I just seemed more like a freakish fan than something wasn't quite lining up right. But Slash came out to this is actually a funny story. I was coming into, I came into town with a Guns N' Roses tattoo on my shoulder. Mm-hmm. And I was in this band Mondo Cane, and we were playing at all of the clubs, and I was still too young to even, you know, I shouldn't have been allowed in the clubs, but we were popular enough that like all the door guys knew who I was. So I was getting on all these clubs. I was like 17, 18 years old. And I remember walking into bar one, and I peeled up my shirt sleeve to show Axl Rose, who was at the end of the bar, my tattoo. And as I'm walking over there, he's surrounded by these supermodels. And as I come over, I think that this guy's just going to love me. I can't believe it. I'm going to meet my hero. And I pull up my shirt sleeve, and he laughs at me. And then all the girls that he's with start laughing at me. My tail just goes between my legs, and I leave the club. And I think I was just so brokenhearted. And to this day, I still have no idea, you know, why he laughed or whatever. But that day, I get this call from I'd done the recordings with Velvet Revolver, and I was doing a show at the Viper Room with my band Aces and Eights, and Slash was reported to have been interested enough that he was going to come out and jump up on stage with us.
Crazy.
And this, yeah. And this is already after the Quiet Riot thing had died off. And I jump up there on stage, and I'm playing, and sure as fuck, he's right there at one of the booths, and I'm like just ripping with adrenaline. And I knew that he was going to come beforehand. So I literally went to that tattoo shop, Howard Tiemann's tattoo shop, that day, and got my Guns N' Roses tattoo covered with a phoenix so that he wouldn't laugh at me.
That's so then, amazing.
Yeah. So then not only did Slash get up that night, and we did an Aerosmith cover and some Guns N' Roses songs, but as he's getting up to put on his guitar, Steven Adler snuck up and got on the drums. And that was their first reunion since they'd broken up and had this bad falling out. So it was like this huge thing. And like literally the Viper Room was so freaking packed with people. Like, I mean, people had to have been getting hurt. I remember one guy punched a guy just to get in, and like the street had blocked off, you know, traffic because there were so many people out the door. I mean, the place just went freaking off. I remember I must have lost 10 pounds that night, just like exerting so much energy. All my friends were there. It was like this huge, huge, crazy thing. It was an out of body experience to be up there playing with these heroes. And then lo and behold, I get a call. Like, I think it was, you know, sometime while I was trying so hard with the Velvet Revolver thing, that whole thing fizzled out, like literally between everybody, you know, right in front of us. Slash went on to do this solo record with every rock star singer that ever was. Mm-hmm. Then of course that turned into his wonderful thing with, you know, one of my huge heroes, also Miles Kennedy, big yeah. Sweetheart.
Love Miles. I've gotten to spend some time with him. It's just a great guy. And yeah. And what's funny is they had invited him to audition back when it was the Project, and he said no.
Interesting. I did not know that.
Which is funny. Yeah. Way, way back in the, you know, before the pre-Weiland days. Cause yeah, wow. it gets confusing that whole timeline, because there were, you know, all of those near misses and people that auditioned and people that they invited to audition who turned them down. And then the second time around, there were all the rumors about all the different people they might get. And then they did that one-off reunion with Weiland. And then Weiland was doing interviews saying they were back together. And then the band was like, no, we're not.
The whole House of Blues thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was there. Yeah. Fuck yeah. I mean, dude, I was just such a huge Weiland fan, man. When he was gone, I lit candles. I cried, you know what I mean? It was fucked up. I loved him so much.
For sure. I loved him a lot too. He's just a huge, massive, massive talent, and really a one of a kind, you know, a type of pure rock star in all the best sort of esoteric senses of the phrase, you know.
Yeah,
there aren't many of those left, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love the
weird sort of otherness about them.
Yeah, I love the way that he, I mean, Stone Temple Pilots too, it's like there's just like I don't even know how to explain, you know, when I pop in Stone Temple Pilots, it's I don't know how to explain what happens to me. You know what I mean? It's like, I feel like I'm taken to a summer day somewhere where the leaves are blowing. Like, it's just like, it's I don't even know. Like I just said, I don't know how to explain it. It takes you to another realm, another reality, you know, when I hear that stuff. And Velvet Revolver too. Like, I was so excited that, that Velvet Revolver was what they were. And why some people say that they didn't climb to the, you know, to the success level that Guns N' Roses did. I felt like it was very important that that band existed and did what they did, because I mean, I loved every single song. You can't, I never get sick of that stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I listened to it over and over. And,
I loved the band a lot too. And I loved, you know, there's some pro shot videos on YouTube where Izzy got up on stage with them at some like festivals and stuff. And
yeah.
Yeah, it was just a very cool band and very cool moment in time. And now going backwards a little bit, you know, it was actually Lemmy who told Slash, who told Matt Sorum that they should give you a try. So where did Lemmy enter into your life?
Yeah, this is, we're going to get a little gritty, you know. I was, I mean, I don't know how much I want to divulge everything because it's, you know, I know, you know, Lemmy lived his lifestyle and he wasn't ashamed of it. You know what I mean? But, to put it simply, I started to date a girl that was like best friends with the band. You know, she was like the quote unquote camera girl, you know, she went on, she was always with the group. She was like the sixth member. I fell in love with her, you know, had nothing to do with the group. We fell in love with each other. We had a mutual bond over drugs. We loved to just, you know, just fade away together. You know, she brought me along to meet Lemmy. Lemmy kind of, you know, he was just, he opened up to me because he loved her so much and she loved me. So it's like, I was accepted in their inner circle immediately. You know what I mean? I saw a lot of people like, I never had to go through the, it just happened. You know what I mean? It was just like, all of a sudden I was at his house. I was at their rehearsals, you know what I mean? And I was just there. I think one day Lemmy leaned over, you know, I'm German. I was fascinated by his collection of, all of this memorabilia he had from World War II, his Nazi memorabilia. And he had gotten some bayonets and like, I think they were still like, they literally still had mud on them. They were dirty.
Oh, wow.
You know, I was with a few more of our friends that were a little shady, you know what I mean? And I remember, you know, Lemmy giving me these artifacts because I told him that, you know, I took jewelry in school and I had, you know, some tools at home that, you know, just that I was like a capable jeweler, you know? And so he hands me these bayonets and asked me if I could clean them up without, you know, damaging them or whatever. So he trusted me with like these, you know, World War II bayonets off of literally Nazi soldiers' guns. And I felt like, I don't know, to me, it was like this magical moment where this guy was this huge, you know, I remember seeing Headbangers Ball back when I was just a fucking baby, you know what I mean? And like seeing Lemmy on the screen and just being like, you know, he's giving you nightmares, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's just like, what is this? It wasn't a person. It was like this huge presence, you know, is just so intimidating, but still so freaking awesome. So
I should forward you the thing I wrote on Christmas Eve, actually, that was about discovering Motorhead for the first time, which for me was on the TV show The Young Ones, when MTV used to show The Young Ones, you know, late at night on Saturdays or whatever.
Yes. Yeah.
And there's Motorhead playing Ace of Spades in the living room. That was my first introduction.
Yeah.
I actually wrote a whole thing about it. I should send that to you.
Yeah, I love that. It's funny. It's, there's so much out there, man. You can never, again, it's like, there's just so much to dive into always. And it's always, he did so much with his life, touched so many people, but yeah, getting in on that inner circle, it was just crazy to me how he opened up and how much of a sweetheart he was. So yeah, he gave me these pieces of jewelry, you know, literally locked the doors. Cause like people like, maybe I was paranoid or whatever, but I felt like everybody just wanted to ruin it. You know what I mean? It was like this test I was given. And, you know, I kept these pieces on me You know what I mean? I literally wouldn't put them down because, like, I mean, I couldn't come home. I mean, I had this huge guitar collection, but I literally couldn't come. I couldn't go out for a couple of days and come back without a guitar being stolen or something missing. You know what I mean? And I just knew that, like, these things were going to disappear if I wasn't careful. So it was like, this was my chance to, like, show him that, like, I gave a fuck, you know what I mean? Beyond whatever.
Yeah.
And so I shined these things up and I brought them back to him. And I could just tell that, like, at that moment, he was just completely at ease with me. And I think that was the day that, like, he literally had like an entire apartment full of guitar cases. And like, he opened every single one. We went through every single guitar. He just told me how special it was, why this one was, you know, why this one makes this sound. And this is what this guy played. And some, you know, whoever, whatever, gave him this guitar, you know, just like, just in awe of this guy. And two or three days would pass, you know what I mean? Before we left the apartment, we'd play video games you know, and just as much of a connection as important of a connection that was, Phil Campbell also became this, you know, super close friend of mine. I mean, I gravitated to him because he was just so crazy. I was just this perverted lunatic that would just do the most crazy shit. I'd get caught doing like the most crazy, sickest sexual stuff all the time. Like I was just out of control. Like I was the guy that was just like, you know, I was a freak, you know what I mean? All my friends just knew I was this freak, you know? And I looked up to Phil because he was just so, you know what I mean? He would come out of the bedroom wearing women's lingerie and, you know, holding like, you know, huge phallic pieces of sex toys and stuff. Like he was just, he didn't care who saw him doing what, you know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, fuck, this guy's my homie, you know what I mean? So I just, we just would laugh and just have the best of time. So we really started spending a lot of time together. And he got a call one day that his roadie wasn't going to be able to come over from overseas, you know, to do the tour. And he literally hung up the phone and, you know, he couldn't finish the sentence. I don't have a roadie for the tour before I said, yes, you do.
Right.
You know, that was it. We went to Guitar Center. We put together a kit. And then literally, I think the next week we went out, you know, everything louder than everything else happened. And that's when I was tuning all their guitars and taking care of all that stuff. So,
and around that time you, Phil was, playing on demos and stuff you were making, right? Like there was music in the mix.
I remember we had this song Demons that, man, everybody there, the opening line of that song was "Don't let anyone put you down," and it was this ballad, but like everybody that came over always would come back and be like, "Patrick, what's up?" And they'd sing the first line of that song to me. So yeah, he played on that. That never really saw the light of day. He did some other stuff that I did at Interscope when I had one of the guys that record that was producing stuff over there took me in. And then Phil ended up recording a song Ska Bra with us on the debut record that we recorded with Lemmy's son, Paul. Mm-hmm. And then we actually recorded the solo that he did on the newest release. We just released that song this week, Pardon Me, off of the newest record. We salvaged the solo that Phil had actually intended to, he recorded with the song Pardon Me was supposed to be on our debut CD, but never got finished. And Paul Lemmy died and Paul ended up leaving the country and we never finished that song. So there was these leftover tracks that Phil had done with us that we ended up stripping that solo away. We used those tracks and completely built the song, rebuilt the song, you know, from the ground up. We recorded it with Jay Baumgartner over there at NRG and still used the solo that Phil did for us for that song. And now we just released that damn thing. So it's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy how all that works out. It happens for a reason, right?
Yeah.
Now, I think I read somewhere that you, through all of the connectivity and comings and goings with all of the Motorhead crew and, you know, band members and manager and all of that, you met Phil Filthy Animal Taylor at some point too, right? He was around?
Yeah, you know, Phil was always around. he would just, he was the one that really just loved to come over and play, you know what I mean? So I would grab a guitar or a bass, and I had this electronic drum kit at my place, and Phil and I would just play for days and days and days and days on end. Oh yeah. Yeah. God rest his soul as well, man. Jeez.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So going out on that Everything Louder tour, what do you remember, you know, what are some of your fond memories of some of the hangs and the, you know, the quiet moments that are as quiet as they can get on a Motorhead tour? You know, aside from the shows themselves and loading in and loading out and all that, like other stuff.
Yeah, it's it all happened so fast, but still so much of that was just, it was so intense that there's so many memories were created in such a short time. You know, I remember just like, again, being like introduced to those guys the way that I was, I didn't quite understand how intimidating of a group of people that they were, and how much chaos there was, because inside of all of that was this, I mean, you couldn't be more organized than those guys were, you know what I mean? You couldn't be more real either. Like, they didn't put up with any bullshit, you know what I mean? You had a job to do. And so there was a lot of stress on getting everything right. So it was hard. It was like, you know, it was definitely hard work. And, the most beautiful thing that I can remember, the most beautiful things was, you know, things like Lemmy taking me into the back of the bus. And he, you know, the guy just didn't stop writing. You know, he was always back there in the back of the bus writing. He always had a pen and paper, and he would bring me back there, and he would hand me lyrics. You know, I think he was writing stuff for like the Black Magic record at that time, and other things. But he would share those lyrics with me, and he literally would ask me like, "What would I, you know, how would I finish this line?" And I remember always just kind of being so in awe of everything I was reading, and it just spoke so much truth to me, and, you know, just being just so grateful for that, for those moments. Like, I knew that that wasn't something that happened to everyone. You know what I mean? It was just, it wasn't like an Instagram moment where you pull out your phone and like, you know, it was just a moment where I just sat there in awe, you know what I mean? Just really super glad that like I could sit there with this guy and share that. Like, I just felt that was very special. All the laughs and the funny things that we did. I mean, like I found out what a dirty Sanchez was, you know? Those kind of things, or like, you know, sharing rooms with Phil and like, you know, I mean, you can only imagine the things that were happening, you know what I mean? But it was, yeah, I think that's the most tender thing of all of it, was, you know, just really, again, just being completely blown away day after day, how sweet these people were, how real they were, how that, you know, inside of this money-making machine and these places to go and the timeline to stick to, that like, there's just a lot of love, you know, there was a lot of love there where, you know, you would think that, you know, I could have never imagined myself inside of that. That would have been the last place I would have imagined myself finding a home. So just,
that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember what your last, conversation or last seeing, Phil Taylor was?
I mean, I can see it in my mind. I'm not really sure what we were talking about. I mean, it was some time before he had passed. It was at that house in Silver Lake that I had, you know. You know, we would sit and talk about, like, I think we always kind of like, we connected on girl troubles. I think he was always kind of a little bit upset about what was going on with a girl at home, if I remember correctly. But yeah, no, he was just a super sweet, again, a way, just, I don't even think I ever really understood why he was, you know, why they moved on from Phil. I mean, I do understand that, you know, people, you know, members and bands can change, you know, you wake up one morning and you think you're that brother, you have that guy for life, and that never, nothing's ever going to change. And then they're gone. But I don't ever remember talking about any, you know, he never had anything bad to say about anybody. He's just a super sweet spirit. I don't really remember exactly what we were talking about. I remember standing in a room, there was a boa constrictor there in the in the tank. There was that drum set, you know. I just remember him being so sweet. Yeah.
Oh. And then of course, you know, I got to ask you the same question about Lemmy.
Yeah. Trying to think of the last time we spoke, honestly, was he must have been his birthday party. Mm. You know, that was we shared it. That was an incredible night. I mean, every rock god you could imagine was in that crowd, and he was sitting up there, and he had just signed us, and you know, he had us out to play that thing. I remember standing on the front of the whiskey stage, and like, I'm not a lead guitar player at all. I've always been like, I mean, I told you my sister gave me my guitar, and mm-hmm. I learned how to play chords, but I've never been that lead guitar player guy. I had to make do with my group that night. I was the lead guitar player that night for whatever reason. Uh-huh. And I remember us playing Folsom Prison Blues, you know, because I think we probably did it because Lemmy was a huge Johnny Cash fan, and you know, the whole night was to celebrate him. So we did that, and I remember it was my turn to do the guitar solo, and here I go stumbling into three notes, you know what I mean, that I know are safe to play, and right in front of me is Lemmy, Zakk Wylde, Steve Vai, Slash, you know, and I'm just like playing these three notes.
Not intimidating at all.
But looking up at Lem and his throne up there, and him just giving me the thumbs up, you know. But I think there was a certain element of, there was already this sadness. Everybody kind of knew there was something going on, you know, at that point. But Lemmy, you know, none of us bought into it, or none of us believed it, you know, at that point. He was just so.
Oh, he's invincible. You know? Yeah. We thought he was going to go and go and go. Like, he was immortal.
Yeah. Whew. That was a sad, sad day. I remember hearing about it. I remember how I heard about it first. But then calling Todd, you know, our manager, you know, and him just, you know, he just completely lost, just all of us losing it, you know, the whole world mourned. We've been mourning ever since. Yep.
I did see, I remember they live streamed the memorial service, and I actually tuned into that. I can't remember any other time that I watched anything like that, actually, but you know, for our community, it was like, oh, this is how people felt like watching Princess Diana's funeral on TV or whatever, you know, like that was for us, that, you know, so I was happy that whoever made the decision to make that public, I thought that was really cool. And
That was Todd. Todd did that. I remember, and some people were trying to give him flack for it, but that's great. Cause people got to share that. I was there. I remember being there.
I figured.
And just, fuck, man, I just like, I just revisited those, just, I don't know, maybe I was, you know, I was missing him a bit or whatever. And I remember I was like, I want to watch that. And I watched Dave Grohl's speech that night. I watched, you know, just so many people got up, and again, just like this monster of a persona, this thing that to so many people drives people to like, just feel so powerful. Everybody that got up there and spoke about him just said almost, it's like everybody said the same exact thing, just how sweet he was, how loving he was, how caring he was, how he would stop everything he was doing to make sure that you felt like you were important, you know? So, woo.
Yeah, man. And you know, we spoke about this before, but my two different experiences getting to meet him, and spend a little time around him, were everything you would want it to be. Like, it's, and that seems to be a universal experience for everyone kind of in that orbit, everyone in our community, everyone who loves hard rock and metal or just appreciates what Lemmy did for music. You know, anytime you hear anyone talking about meeting him or, you know, going up to him at the Rainbow or whatever it was, I've never once heard a bad story.
Right. They're just not out there. That's just, you know, that's Yeah. Like if I could learn anything from him, that's, you know, I've said it before. It's just like the integrity and like, you know, if I can be that kind of person, you know, at sometimes it's like, yeah, I was just talking to Todd, you know, our manager again, he's still our manager the other day. And believe it or not, we were not arguing about it, but you know, Butterside's trying to take on a life of our own. And yet, you know, the call to arms is always, there's Lemmy's in the mix, you know what I mean? And and we're talking about how we can step away from that. You know, we don't want to be tailgating on that. You know what I mean? It's like Lemmy would want us to shine above and be ourselves. And like, you know, you know, Todd was talking about how, like, you know, Lemmy being who he was, often he sacrificed a lot of the fame and a lot of the celebrity that might have gone along with things and choices that he could have made to have made himself more whatever, you know, to sell out in some certain kind of way. But, you know, I've kind of, you know, it's taking me a good pretty minute to get to where I want to go with my career. And I'm still super confident that it's getting to where it needs to be. And I will have that dance with the devil in the pale moonlight, so to speak.
I understood that reference. I'm that gif right now.
And I think I will get there due to the fact that, like, you know, a lot of rock stars that have gone to the very tippy top of the iceberg and have sunk back down and come back into reality. All of them respect the same thing that the other ones do. And that is that Lemmy, you know, he didn't necessarily plateau, because the dude's fame and fortune, not his fame and his legend grows still every day. He's still becoming bigger. I mean, as far as I can tell. But like they all respect him for his integrity and his, you know, sticking to his guns and being who he is. So that's, again, something I took from being around them is like why it might have hindered me this long. I feel like in the long run, you know, trying to be a real person and trying to be sweet to other people and not stepping on other people to get to where you want to go and just being who you are. And, you know, all the things he stood for underneath the heavy exterior, you know what I mean? That the image and the persona, which goes hand in hand with him, actually. I mean, he was always exactly who he was. There was no separating who Lemmy was on stage or, you know, who he was with me in the back of the bus. You know what I mean? This sweet guy that's just, anyway, you know, Todd was saying that, you know what I mean? He made a lot of sacrifices that he didn't think were sacrifices. He thought that those, you know, that's how you should be. And that's why he is who he is to us, you know? So I hope that someday, you know, if one person on the planet sees some kind of, you know, that kind of thing in me, which, you know, a lot of the people that I love and respect now in my life, you know, those are the things that mean the most to them. And those are the things that are actually getting me somewhere with my career, is the fact that, like, you know, just being a genuine human being, yes, you know, very important.
I had that conversation with an old friend of mine just yesterday about how, you know, eventually you come around to this notion that it's really about relationships and people and who you want to spend your time around. As much as we all work hard to achieve our goals and advance our careers or whatever it might be, you know, we only have so much time in this place, and who you are spending that time with matters, you know? So yeah, I would definitely take the trade to be surrounded by and working with great people that maybe doesn't get me as far up the ladder, so to speak, as being around some terrible people might. it's a trade, you know, and Lemmy's a great example of someone like that, of an icon who, you know, did things his own way, blazed his own path, you know, was never, you know, Motorhead never sold like Limp Bizkit records, you know, in terms of sales, but right, you know, who would you rather be when you wake up, Lemmy or Fred Durst? You know, like,
exactly.
No offense, Fred, but you know,
yeah, yeah. Coming full circle, you know, I'm sitting here watching Metallica on my, I got just some videos looped, coming full circle on the whole reason that we're all here together today. Metallica, I mean, their fucking hugest hero, you know, was Lemmy.
Absolutely.
And you know what I mean? They took what he had and they had a, you know, whatever it was, amazing. You know, they didn't sell out to get where they were either. Metallica definitely didn't. They were the real, you know, it's just like the wave came in and it's like, it's like Lemmy was the earthquake offshore that created the wave, you know what I mean? And then Metallica was that wave that rode in, and just like, you know, people don't, maybe some people still don't realize that when they're listening to Metallica, they're listening to Lemmy, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going all the way back to Lars, you know, following Metallica around on tour when he was a teenager, to, you know, Lemmy's 50th birthday party when they did the show and dressed as the Lemmys, where they all wore the Lemmy wigs and did a bunch of Motorhead songs, the Motorheadache, as they called it. Yeah, just the love was obviously so mutual and shared. And of course, they did that great song about Lemmy that was on Hardwired with the video and all of that. Did you, during your travels in the Motorhead camp, did you ever cross paths with the Metallica guys?
I have not. No, it's funny because, again, talking, I'm hoping it will happen soon. One of my dearest friends and a huge Butterside supporter, one of our biggest, he's basically my, and he's the number two guy, whether you know, like it or not. He's put up, you know, he's helped us with producing a few things. My boy, Rob Marishoff is like, he's part of the, whatever it is, the Metallica militia VIP, you know what I mean? He flies out to see them in Amsterdam, and like, he's got front row and he sees them at the, just that San Francisco Symphony thing they did.
Awesome.
2020. Yeah. He was front row. Yeah. That
was actually the last live show I saw before the pandemic.
Sweet.
I went up to my buddy and I went up for the first night of that.
Yeah, so epic. But he and I still get as excited as we did when we were kids when we listened to Metallica or talk about them. And then you bring Eric German into the mix, and like we went to meet with Eric, you know, right around the time I realized that, you know, hey, I think that I'm, you know, I'm ready to swing with the big dog. So let's have a meeting with this Eric German guy, and I'm going to bring my investor guy. So Eric knows that, like, you know, no matter what kind of trouble we get into, we can afford to get out of it or whatever, you know, it just, he felt like the right guy to bring. But then, you know, an hour at lunch we spent talking about, but you know, those two started talking about Metallica, and we started talking about Metallica. And then, you know, yeah, I think Rob was literally trying to drag Eric all the way up to San Francisco to see that show with him. And then Eric couldn't make it for one or another reason, but Eric's still kicking himself for not going. But I'm sure that the next Metallica thing that comes along, I'm pretty sure all three of us will go. And I hope I can meet those guys, because, yeah, huge influence. Yeah. Just hardcore. Every time I pick up a guitar, it's like, you know, the crunch has got to be like, you know, the Metallica crunch before you can even think about miking it up.
Yeah, man. Amen to that. Well, that's a perfect spot to land the plane, my friend. That was very well said, and very well. I appreciate you sharing what I know are very personal and important memories. You know, for someone who we all love from afar or up close, or every space on the map in between, and someone who's so important to Metallica, it's, you know, I love having you on to talk about that. And of course, people should check out Butterside, knowing not only were you part of that inner circle, but that you were, it's one thing to be friends with someone. It's another thing to have that person vouch for you and tell, you know, Slash that you should sing for his band, right, and, you know, sign your group to his label and put you together with his manager and all. I mean, that speaks volumes. And I know what you mean. It's the case for a lot of artists where, you know, it's a blessing and a curse sometimes to be so associated with another artist. But man, if there's going to be a little shadow over you, that's the one you want, right? Like that's,
yeah, no, it's nothing short. I mean, it's just an honor to have, for those things to have happened. And if Metallica, or if, you know, Metallica fans, if Motorhead fans, if anybody has if they have any respect or love for Lemmy, then, you know, if that, to know that you're rooting for Butterside, as funny as of a name as it is, he loved the name, as different as we were from them with the debut record, he loved that about us. talking about being introduced to a lot of new music. I mean, Lemmy was always introducing me to things that I never thought he would have liked. So if you're rooting for Butterside, you're rooting for Lemmy, you know what I mean? He created that label. He it's something to live up to, you know what I mean? So if you push us and you listen to us, you know, for that very reason, you know, if you help us along just by giving us one listen on Spotify or whatever else, just because out of respect for him, then, you know, we thank you for it. We love you for it. You know, we're heading into great things. We got so much stuff. Butterside has so much material to release and we've done so many things during this lockdown. We've just got, you know, so much stuff to hand to you. And it's just the only nerve wracking thing is that it can only come out so fast. So, right. You know, if people tune in now, you're going to see, incredible growth because, right now we're just now starting to release the stuff that I think is really going to make a difference in our legacy. And it just gets harder, heavier, more meaningful. We're just getting better at it. Again, like I said, it's been a long time coming for me, but the guys in the group now are all fresh and young, and there's just this wonderful energy and this hunger to get there. And, we're all huge Motorhead Metallica fans, and it all comes from there, and where we end up, nobody knows, but you know, but we'll take, you know, Lemmy's recommendation to get us into your ears any day.
Exactly. Amazing. And it's something people should check out, of course, as it stands on its own. And I'll make sure all the relevant information is in there. And yeah, if there's been any kind of glass half full for creative types with the pandemic, it's, that extra time where you didn't have anything else to do except create.
Yeah.
So for sure. Well, dude, Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you. Thank really you, Ryan. It was awesome. Super great.
Super fun. And yeah, we hit it off so well doing the bio thing where I was just like, Kelly was like, hey, what do you think about him for the Metallica podcast? I was like, you kidding? Like, yeah, let's do that tomorrow.
Fuck yeah. Hell yeah.
So yeah, worked out perfect.
Yeah. I wish I had some videos of us playing those songs in the garage, man.
Oh man.
Gosh. Man, those just parties where we were playing Metallica songs and just kids just hanging out of the windows. You know what I mean? People just running around like lunatics, just where it all started, man.
Yeah, man. That was, first time I ever got in a room with people playing instruments. We did Metallica covers. So it was, such a part of the formative experience for so many of us.